The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is out now, and it's all about AI and creativity. I speak to Doug Eck, Senior Research Director at Google DeepMind.
Creativity is part and parcel of humanity.
YouTube creator Danny Vidari.
AI can give us humans new ideas.
And Neil Maiden, Professor of Digital Creativity at City University London.
AI creates a lot of opportunities. I think it's a great leveler.
Listen to the full episode of The Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts. Enjoy.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
Vinyl records are a pleasure to the ear. Can they also be a valuable asset? The hidden dangers of time-worn investment cliches, and why millennials are more susceptible than most to the lure of online gambling. Welcome to The Money Show, the FT's weekly podcast on personal finance and investing. I'm James Pickford, Deputy Editor of FT Money, and I'll be giving you this week's money news in downloadable form. For those of us of a certain age, the look, feel and sound of vinyl records evoke feelings of undeniable nostalgia. If you've managed to cling onto your record collection through the era of CDs, MP3s and streaming music, you've proved your loyalty to the format. But have you ever stopped to ask yourself what it might be worth? This week I emerged from the FT Audio studio to go and meet Ludovic Hunter-Tilney, the FT's pop critic, who has been doing just that and has written about the experience for FT Money.
Well, that's a wonderful sound. Thank you very much, Ludovic Hunter-Tilney. I'm here with him in his sitting room in London, in Queen's Park, and we are surrounded by records. Ludo, that was, I think we all know who that was, but can you tell us a bit about it?
Well, absolutely, James. This, of course, was a Tomorrow Never Knows, the classic track on the side, last song on side B of Revolver, the Beatles' 1966 album, the sort of transitional album where they began to become the sort of psychedelic out there explorers of their latter part of their career. Now, this album, which I have in the mono recording, this is in the mono recording. If I had had the first pressing in which Tomorrow Never Knows was actually a shorter version was run on there, record would be worth about £400.
Wow, that's extraordinary. So, you have any idea what it's worth now?
Well, actually, unfortunately, this record I've inherited from my parents-in-law, who had the foresight to buy it. They didn't quite have the foresight to buy the very first pressing, but they did buy the second pressing of the mono, which is worth less. This copy that I have is still going to be worth about £60 or so.
Very good.
It's in decent enough condition. And
well, great. I mean, tell us a little bit. You've been spending a few weeks looking at your extensive record collection acquired over sort of 30 years as a pop critic. What have you learnt about the experience of doing that and the rules and the things one should look out for?
I've learnt that my records are basically worth more than I thought they would be, that there has been an appreciation in value during the 2010s, which has been really quite dramatic. So for a long time, my record collection, which is composed essentially of inherited records from my parents and my parents-in-law, a smattering of records that belong to my wife, which I've now sort of taken over, I incorporated into my own, and then a lot of my own records which were bought in the 80s and 90s principally, with a few from the 2000s. I've discovered that the value of those has remained pretty constant, but then has gone up very steeply in the last sort of 8 years or so.
So how do you go about valuing your collection?
Well, James, there's an online site for doing so. There are several online sites, but the one I used is an online marketplace called Discogs. And that has a tool whereby people can go and calculate the value of the records they have based upon what people on that site have paid for in the past. you key in your catalogue number, you try to work out which issue it is. It's a very arduous process because records come out in numerous issues. And there are obviously also counterfeit copies, of which I discovered one among my collection. Yes, which I suppose I should really snap and throw away. And then having done that, I went off to a record shop, a secondhand record shop called Flashback Records on Essex Road. And I spoke to its owner, Mark Burgess, in order to go and have the values that I had discovered to have them verified by an expert.
And so what sorts of things did he reveal to you? Things that you found surprising, things that you weren't expecting to see?
He revealed to me that, I mean, I knew that rare records were worth money, rarities. What I didn't quite gather was the extent to which, how many rarities there are, I suppose, oddly enough. And it's to do with little things, just like the Tomorrow Never Knows track being shorter on the first pressing. It's to do with small typographical mistakes that turn up on labels. It's to do with the Bob Dylan Blonde on Blonde album that I have, which is a gatefold album. That's another parent-in-law bequest.
I believe you've got one record which is which shows the value of a particular era.
Yes, so my records that I bought in the 90s, in mid-90s especially, was a very good time in order to be buying records. So I'm just going to put on a record from a classic from that era, which is Pulp's album Different Class, which was released in 1995 at the height of the Britpop boom. And let me put this on. So there we are. We have Jarvis Cocker in his pomp in that wonderful song, singing about the freaks and the outcasts of the world. Wonderful album. Anyway, I was surprised to discover that that album in mint condition, or near mint, would be about £80.
That's quite surprising. And is that because that was the period when vinyl was no longer being produced?
That's right. So at that point, vinyl began to lose its dominance in the 80s. Cassettes actually took over. By the end of the 80s, cassettes were outselling vinyl in terms of albums, but the CD was its sort of near death knell. And from about sort of the mid-90s onwards, there were fewer vinyl records being pressed up and many more CDs. So, to give an example, if I had bought my copy of Nirvana's Nevermind, which came out in 93 on CD, it might be worth about £2 now, possibly, but I have the vinyl copy, which again is well played and is worth about £50. In this case, we have this album, which originally came out with a whole number of 12 different inserts, so a special edition again. I don't have that special edition. If you did have it, it would be worth about £200. Nonetheless, my copy, which has been played a great deal, is in sort of good condition, possibly very good according to the way they go and grade vinyl quality. It's worth about £45.
Just before we wrap up, could you tell me about new music, new vinyl? Is it worth buying these things for the same reasons you've described, you know, buying the previous
vinyl? So new vinyl is currently, we are seeing a boom in new vinyl. That there were over 4 million vinyl albums sold last year in the UK, which was the most since the early 90s. At the moment, new vinyl comes out, I mean, it's sort of, although it seems expensive, they're about £20 an album, I suppose. In fact, they've kept more or less in pace with inflation, that the £5.50 that my wife paid for her copy of Prince's Love Sexy in 1988 would now be roughly £16 or £17. And so, actually, they're not so much. Now, I've got a copy here of Radiohead's most recent album, A Moon-Shaped Pool. This album I have played only once because I also have the digital version. As soon as I played it, so I'm going to put this album, Radiohead's A Moon-Shaped Pool, new copy. I'm going to get an open with the very first song, the excellent Burn the Witch. Wonderful song, and the quality is absolutely excellent. It's nice, thick vinyl. They tend to sell them in 180-gram discs at the moment, although there's a problem with sourcing enough vinyl. At any rate, handsome things. By playing that album, I've sort of reduced its value by some 20% or so.
Just by opening it up.
Just by opening it up and playing it. Even though the copy I have is in near mint condition because I haven't played it very often. So I've reduced its value simply by playing it by about 20%. However, it will probably keep that value, that reduced value, over time. It's unlikely to grow hugely because lots of other of these have now been produced. There are other issues which are coming out at the moment. In terms of collecting new vinyl, the thing to look out for are the limited editions, which come out, and such as those on Record Store Day, which is set up in order to help independent record stores, which is the April 21st, this weekend. And they tend to stock all sorts of rarities and limited editions. If you buy those, then you could see their value, or you're liable to see their value appreciate over time.
Ludovic Hansa-Tilney, thank you very much indeed. You can read more about how to value your record collection, or indeed your entire music collection, in his cover feature for FT Money this weekend.
Most personal investors don't spend a great deal of time analysing the outlook of the companies they're invested in, at least not to the extent that a professional fund manager might. Yet they do decide the kinds of things they're going to invest in, and they think about when to put their money down and when to take it out. Miles Johnson, capital markets editor, has been thinking about what guides people when they make those decisions, and he's come to some rather unsettling conclusions. Miles, thanks for joining us. How does the average individual investor operate when they're making decisions about their investments?
Well, I think there's a lot of literature existing which shows that the average investor actually tends to underperform the market, mainly due to what we could label sort of behavioral issues, where people frequently sort of, to put it simply, will buy high and sell low, or get worried, you know, when the market sort of moves around a lot and make decisions that are sort of contrary to their interests.
Mm. Now, you've written this week about investment cliches for us. Can you give us some examples of the kind of thing you're talking about there?
Well, what I intended with the article is basically to discuss kind of popular investment wisdom, which I have referred to as sort of cliches, which I think is correct to some extent, where these are wise concepts, but at the same time, if they're sort of only applied in a sort of half-hearted manner or in an incorrect way, they can actually result in adverse results for the investor. So these are often ideas that are extremely important to investing, but can become dangerous weapons if they are applied in the wrong way. And so, you know, one of those would be, for example, the classic would be you have to be a long-term investor or a buy and hold investor. And that's advice which I think is very good. I think actually the main problem that individual investors often have is that they are unable to sit and do nothing. It's very hard to just leave your investments and not mess around with them, get worried due to some kind of, you know, piece of news, try and time the market, incur costs. These are all things which have detrimental effects on people. But that said, people need to understand why being a long-term investor is a good thing, not just being a long-term investor for the sake of it. And so an example that I gave is obviously the idea that, you know, people believe sometimes that just being a long-term investor can on its own save a bad investment, and that the key thing to being a long-term investor is that you invest in good things which appreciate in value over time, that compound their intrinsic value over time. If you invest in bad things, if you hold them for a long period of time, it's not going to do you any good. If you invest in, you know, the example I give sort of is magic beans or some completely valueless nonsense, you know, if you hold it for 50 years, it's still going to be valueless nonsense in 50 years. The fact that you've held it for 50 years makes absolutely no difference whatsoever.
So I'd have thought that one of the ways of guarding against falling into these traps is by diversifying, because that ensures a certain amount of damage limitation. Or is that in itself an investment cliche?
Well, I think that's arguably even the bigger kind of piece of perceived, popular investment wisdom, even more than being a long-term investor, is the idea, you know, do not put all your eggs in one basket. Diversification is a means of protecting your wealth. I think, again, that's broadly correct. I think that no one is going to do too badly in life by following that mantra. But that said, you can also make mistakes. People can basically, again, diversify into bad investments. There's, you know, a kind of most recent example would be so-called alt coins, or, you know, different alternative coins to Bitcoin. So they were labeled alt coins. And there was a mad speculative rush at the end of last year where the prices of these magic coins were going up sort of to insane levels. And, you know, there were things like promising, you know, there was one coin which was promising to disrupt the global dentistry industry. And, you know, there's actually one at the moment which I thought was the best I've ever seen, which is where it's trying to raise money in a so-called initial coin offering to try and discover a lost galleon full of gold off the Florida coast.
Wonderful.
And so if you diversify into a bunch of these coins, you may hold 20 of them. That doesn't mean that you're probably not going to lose all of your money, which quite a lot of people already have.
Yes. So is the conclusion that we should pay others to do our thinking for us?
I think, broadly speaking, well, you know, that gets us into a different debate. I mean, you know, there are long-standing debates over the merits of active management versus so-called passive management and fees and these things. And I think that, broadly speaking, all of these, you know, being diversified, being a long-term investor, you know, not paying too, losing too much to fees. These are all extremely important points. Not trying to time the market, spending time in the market, allowing your wealth to compound. These are all things that are important. But that said, people, whether they do it through, you know, someone else managing their money, or someone else managing their money may well be making the same mistake. It's basically people, it's not practical for the vast majority of people to spend a large amount of time doing the research and spending the effort needed to kind of run their own investment. But, you know, people should just be careful. They should always just use it as a sanity check to make sure that they're not making horrific blunders and excusing those blunders with a sort of butchered version of popular investment wisdom, saying, oh, I own this ludicrous coin, but I'm a long-term holder, so it's all going to be okay in the end. It's not going to be all okay in the end.
Thanks very much there to Miles Johnson, FT Capital Markets editor. You can read more from him about the perils of investment cliches in this weekend's FT Money. We move seamlessly from dangerous investment ideas to outright gambles. Kate Bearley, a writer for FT Money, has noticed a growing number of her millennial friends getting into online gambling, putting money on horses, football matches, political events, all sorts of things, usually through apps that they can easily access on their mobile phones. Kate, it sounds here like several trends have converged to boost gambling among this age group. What's happening?
Yeah, well, I think one of the key ones is it has become far easier to gamble on your phone. I mean, this is clearly an age group already obsessed with our mobile phones, and that makes it easier to gamble more frequently and gamble more. At the same time, betting companies have grown even more kind of sophisticated at marketing special offers to gamers and pushing free bets to you, which often pop up as notifications on your phone. And then there are also more and more things to gamble on now. So you can gamble on increasingly arcane things, not just a case of betting win or lose in a football match. It's kind of esoteric things within football matches, or any number of things to do with Donald Trump. And this is disproportionately affecting young people. Millennials were responsible for the largest increase in online gambling of any age group last year. They're more likely than any other to have gambled at least once in the previous 4 weeks when the lottery stripped out. And they're more likely to bet regularly on esports and online casino games than any other age group now.
So, but some people might say, come on, this is just harmless, occasional flutter, a bit of fun. What sort of sums are we talking about? Is it something more substantial than that?
Well, according to charity Gamble Aware, gamblers who are not at risk bet an average £14 a day, and they're betting between 2 and 7 times a day. So not insignificant. They say that problem gamblers spend an average £98 a day. But even if people aren't spending much every time, I think frequency is an issue here. People are betting more and more frequently. So even if the amounts are small, you know, they soon add up.
Yeah. And of course, millennials are the age group that are most likely to want to be saving. So I guess this sort of expenditure isn't going to help.
Yeah, well, quite. I mean, it's quite easy, I think, to think saving is a bit hopeless for some young people. I mean, without help, saving up for a house deposit can feel like a really, you know, long way off. And all the kind of negative headlines about pensions are also pretty scary for young people. So I think there is sometimes a tendency to feel like, oh, you know, what's the point? Apparently, one third of millennials will never own their own home, according to the Resolution Foundation. But at the same time, this kind of unconscious, kind of consistent spending is obviously not doing anyone any favours, really.
And one presumes it's very easy to sign up to these online gaming sites or apps.
Yeah, it's very, very easy to sign up. And most people who are kind of into gambling or gaming will have more than one account. So you could end up with, several of these apps on your phone. Obviously, you can put limits on your spending. The companies let you do that, but you could also easily remove those.
If you think you've got a problem, is there any help you can get either on the app itself or elsewhere?
Yeah, well, I think the main place to get help are places like GamCare, which is a national helpline, the Be Gamble Aware website, and there are a ton of organisations listed on the Gambling Commission's website, which I think would be the first port of call.
Thank you very much there to Kate Bearley. You can read more of Kate's thoughts on the mobile gambling trend in her Millennial Money column this weekend. That's all from The Money Show this week. If you've got a story you'd like the FT Money team to follow up or a question to pose to our team of financial experts, do get in touch. Email us money@ft.com, tweet us at @ftmoney, or comment on our articles online at ft.com/money. We'll be back next Thursday at the usual time. Goodbye.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.